News Talk Radio in 3, 2, 1. Download complete. CFRB 1010.
D-Ball!
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, Mama. Roll.
Here's the hope, here's the hope, here's the hope.
Good evening. My name is Errol Brewsnap. Welcome, listeners, to The Big Stick here in Toronto, around the world via Real Audio on the World Wide Web, and on 6070 kilohertz in the 49-meter band shortwave to Strange Days. Indeed, the 124th program about the increasingly intriguing phenomena of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight on Strange Days Indeed, a report of strangeness near Hudson Bay, more unidentified flying objects over Australia, UFOs visited an institute before the Washington earthquake, and John Glenn confesses on Frasier. Yeah, right. Okay, moving into the week's UFO news and updates. The Feb 27th issue of the Border Watch newspaper said that there were several reports of unidentified flying objects along South Australia's southeast coastline last week. Four people sitting in a car near Port Macdonald Lighthouse last Tuesday night described what they believe was a UFO. Their sighting has been verified by two other witnesses. The object was flying in the vicinity of Victoria toward the ocean. The witnesses' descriptions of the object are virtually identical to two sightings near Port Macdonald Lighthouse, the other one near Mumbanar. Witnesses described a large, white, hazy object in the sky which moved at incredible speed, then more slowly, and it ended up hovering. People traveling in a car at 12:40 a.m. last Tuesday night saw the object near Mumbanar. Their description matches that of the separate sightings at Port Macdonald and seems to describe an object which moved in a huge arc across the sea and then inland. It was moving at varying speeds and just disappeared in a flash. The Victorian witnesses who phoned Trevor Rayner and Diane Harrison said that they'd contacted the Weather Bureau, but there was no balloon activity. The five people who saw the object at Port Macdonald or McDonnell are convinced that they saw a UFO and were apparently quite freaked out by the incident, as a lot of people are. Thanks to George Filer's files, Oz researcher Trevor Rayner, and Diane Harrison, who's the national director of the Australian UFO Research Network, for that one. Two UFOs visited the Self-Mastery Earth Institute a couple of days prior to the magnitude 6.6 earthquake, apparently. That's the one that rocked the state of Washington on Wednesday, February the 28th. The institute, based on a ranch in Trout Lake, Washington, located about 40 miles or 64 clicks northeast of Portland, Oregon, has been the site of many UFO encounters in the past year. The institute is located right in the middle of the earthquake zone. Ranch owner James A. Gilliland reported, and we've talked about Jim Gilliland on this program over the last 2.5 years. He often reports UFOs. He said, due to clouds, rain, and snow and sub-zero temperatures on Mount Adams, there had not been any sightings lately, but all that changed Sunday night, Feb 25th, when they saw at approximately 8:30 p.m. on Sunday night a very large red-colored object that flew and hovered at around 2,000 feet. It was silent, brilliant red, and when they signaled it, the object hovered directly over the main lodge at the Institute. Although the UFO did not communicate with them or provide any sort of explicit warning about the impending earthquake, Gilliland said the object's motions were unsettling. Not a good sign, he reported. The brilliant craft, from their understanding, is one that they try to avoid if possible. if there were real strange energies all around that night, then they didn't feel good about it, and they certainly didn't that night. On Monday night, February the 26th, again at around 8 p.m., they were outside due to a telepathic signal, Gilliland says. The psychics were feeling a benevolent presence in the area. They looked straight up over the main lodge and saw a very large golden-white object, larger than the first one, which was red, coming in from the north, directly from Mount Adams. It was at a lower elevation, about 1,500 feet, and it went directly over the main lodge and then disappeared in the exact location as this first object did. Now, the interesting thing about this report is that Joe Traynor, whose UFO Roundup email letter this story comes from, notes that the UFO Roundup, or that UFO Roundup, received James Gilliland's report 24 hours before the Seattle earthquake. So UFOs predicting earthquakes out in Seattle, apparently. And regular correspondent Chris Rutkowski said in an email on Thursday of this week that he'd received a nicely detailed case report through the Canadian Department of Transportation about a UFO seen in the northern town of Kujawarapik. That's Kujawarapik. Kujawarapik is an Inuit village located on the east side of Hudson Bay, south of the Manitounik Islands on the north shore of the Great Whale River. And it has a population of, at last count, 630. And around 9 p.m. local time on March 5th, two witnesses observed a noiseless object in the sky, an estimated 150 to 200 feet away from houses near the edge of town. This thing was flashing colors of green, red, white, and blue, and pink. And every time it changed color, it became very bright, and then it would again change color. It appeared to be passing the community to the west. The witnesses went to the home of another man, and the group watched together as the object got higher than about 4 or 5 miles west of town. It seemed to land on ice, and then at some point it moved from side to side with the colors continuing to change. And there it remained in one spot, with the lights getting weaker and weaker. And then 2 or 3 hours later, the lights went out. A call and a report to the local radio station resulted in calls from many other people who saw it too. Now, Chris Rutkowski said in his email that this case seemed interesting until he read the part about 2 or 3 hours. Chris says that he feels the object was, to quote him, almost certainly Venus. Nevertheless, an interesting multi-witness case. Odd, though, that the people who live up in those latitudes wouldn't recognize Venus, having it there ever since time immemorial, as far as they're concerned. But maybe they just didn't. An interesting multi-witness case. I hope someone does a follow-up. One more? Okay. Sir Salve wrote to UFO Updates email list this week about the Charlie Rose Show on PBS last Tuesday, March 6th. It was an interesting. It featured a 30-minute interview with Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files, and Serge reports that during the course of the 30-minute interviews, the words, remember who Charlie Rose is talking to, Chris Carter, the words UFO, flying saucer, aliens, extraterrestrial, abduction, and secrecy were never uttered. Imagine doing an interview with Chris Carter and not mentioning any of those words. Serge complains that Carter was never asked where he got all his ideas, nor if he believed all this stuff. There was no mention whatsoever of the show's main theme. Serge says that Charlie Rose achieved a tour de force by presenting extracts of scenes from The X-Files without, at first, placing them in context. Serge observed that talking to Chris Carter with no mention of UFOs is like interviewing the Pope with no mention of religion, or Joe D'Amato without a mention of sex. Censorship at its best is what Serge claims. This was a deliberate avoidance of the subject of UFOs on mainstream, serious, informative TV. Aside from being a confounding experience for him, Serge says the implications are a little frightening. Well, the stories come in and we present them to you and you decide. That's the way it is, these strange days indeed. That's the name of the program. Strange days indeed. My name, Errol Brewsnap. If you want to get in touch with us, you're out there listening somewhere else on the planet other than Southern Ontario, sdi@cfrb.com is the email address. The email program is up on the monitor. The screen has nothing on it, and look forward to getting your emails during the course of the program. Of course, there will be things to email us about. And talking about the internet, Don Ledger asked me, we neglected to mention his website when he was on the last time. So Don Ledger's website, Don Ledger is one of the researchers and one of the authors of the Shag Harbor incident. The name just totally escapes me, and Don is out there listening on the web and is now totally upset with me. Yeah. Well, his website, anyway, go there, take a look. DonLedger.com. www.DonLedger.com. With us tonight is regular correspondent, ufological observer, author, and teacher Dave Furlott. Do you remember the name of the Shag Harbor incident book, Dave?
Oh, good. Get me into the same pit with you.
We're going down together, Furlott.
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, no.
And he took it right from the files, too.
Yeah.
As I recall.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, while you take over, I'm just going to surf on over to the site and
get the book
and get the book name, you see, because I'm just going to go over to DonLedger.com. Here with his take on it this week is Dave Furlott.
Thanks, Errol. Now, the silence from NASA regarding images from Mars has been enough to blind most of us to whatever we see, but to some of us, what we see there has been so disquieting that we should not only be asking for answers, we should be demanding them. I'm not talking about the Cydonia region of Mars, nor am I even talking about the face on Mars. What I'm talking about is a picture that shows several tubular images that have been affectionately called the glass worms. Renowned author Arthur C. Clarke has also seen these images, and his voice has been the first one of notable repute to ask what these things are, and in his view, we should all be asking what these things are because they are that dramatic. For our listeners who wish to examine these images themselves, they can go to www.enterprisemission.com and take a look. What you'll see when you get a look at these images should surprise you. The worm term is probably the most effective because of the winding nature and the almost rib-like structures that seem evident. Additionally, the glass term is apropos because there is a transparent quality to the thing. Now, in reality, that should be enough by itself to get people asking questions, but there's still more to these images. John Velez recently noted that an item that appears to be inside one of the glass worms appears to be traveling through it and can be seen leaving a trail in its wake of something, either a gas or some other substance, which would indicate movement of some nature. Now, in my own examination of the picture, I believe that what we're looking at inside the worm is also completely spherical. I would compare the item that I'm looking at as being similar to a ball bearing. And to be perfectly honest, the first thing I thought of as soon as I saw it was that it was a ball bearing rolling through a transparent vacuum hose. But that's not all. When you zoom in on the image even closer, a dark shape close by and outside the worm seems to reveal itself as being some kind of a delta-winged craft, similar to a modern jet fighter. Now, needless to say, the UFO updates list has carried this thread throughout the week, and although there has been much speculation about the sphere, the craft, and the trail from the sphere, there can be no doubt that the glass worms bear further investigation. We've had several of the list members saying that the glass worm is nothing more than sand dunes that have been blown about by the winds of Mars, but in John Velez's opinion, and also in my own, there can be no way that sand dunes could show up as being transparent like that. Now, it is fine and good for us on the list and for a few others to talk amongst ourselves about what these images are, but the only people with the resources to be able to actively determine for sure what they are reside in Houston. And it's about time they listen to us. We are past the time of asking NASA to share information with us, and we're past the time where we ask NASA to investigate something for us. It's time we demand that NASA shares information, and it's time we demand that they investigate certain regions of Mars on our behalf. In other words, Houston, you have a problem. But that's just my take on it.
Yeah, they certainly do, and a good take it is too, Dave. Yeah, I find it difficult to believe that those things that we're looking at www.enterprisemission.com are sand dunes. I'm sorry, you're looking through something.
Yeah,
translucent.
Yeah, it's perfectly obvious that there is something there, regardless of anything else. It's enough of an anomaly that it warrants investigation. You follow?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not as if you're looking at something and you're going, well, that's just, you know, what you think you see, or, you know, that really is just... It's enough that it gets people questioning themselves and asking, what the hell is it?
Yeah.
So, let's go find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's investigate the damn thing, and it's time to stop pussyfooting around with NASA. I mean, NASA is the boys with the big stick. It's time for the people to turn around and say, hey, listen, you guys are a public agency.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. We want to know what this is. Find out for us.
Yep. Go ahead, Joe Canadian.
Well, hey. Yeah, but I mean, if we could get a couple of our American friends, like we could get John Velez in there.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Mr. Nice and Quiet Guy.
Yeah, well.
Mr. Totally Non-Physically Threatening Guy. Yeah.
Well, he won't shoot at it.
No. No, but you're absolutely right. It's time. I don't know, what else they can do. They flew right over it. They took the pictures. They made no comments about it at all.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that is annoying, is, like, they, above all people, I mean, that's what they've got all those brains down there for.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to look at that thing and at least make some kind of, even an educated guess.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that probably what's gone on is that they flew with Viking. They flew and expecting not very much, and have been just totally overwhelmed by it, the discoveries that they've made.
Yeah.
And science for so long has told us that it's lifeless, and you know the soil is red, and the sky is red, and it's the red planet. And well, you know those stories of
the doctoring of the photographs,
and the monitors.
Yeah,
at JPL, you know, somebody ran around and tweaked all the TV sets so that they made extra red.
Yeah,
and in reality, you know,
it isn't red.
The color pictures that are coming back of Mars are, well.
Blue skies
and soil looks like down here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, sometimes you got to wonder with the people as to, you know, where their brains are at. Are they afraid that what are we going to do? Go out and jump off cliffs like lemmings or something if we find out that, you know, some piece of news from Mars?
Yeah. Well, I'd go shave my beard off. If I found out there was an ancient civilization, or there was civilizational life on Mars, yeah, I think that's, I'd be fairly, maybe even my eyebrows too.
Your beard and your eyebrows.
Yeah.
As a good friend and what have you, and being in the same city, I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, okay. I've done it before, I'll do it again.
Okay.
Hey, Don Ledger's book, it's called Dark Object, Harbor Incident.
Dark Object.
Whew. Joining us. His monthly correspondent, Stephen G. Bassett, the only lobbyist registered to represent the interests of UFO ET research activist organizations in Washington, D.C. Steve, in July 1999, founded the Extraterrestrial Phenomena Political Action Committee, or XPAC. That's X-PPAC, a funding target that serves people who want the cover-up to end sooner than later. Good evening, Steve. Welcome back to the program.
Good evening, Earl. Dave, nice to be with you.
Hey, good to hear you, Stephen.
Yeah, Dave is like you. He's on the phone from home, and we were just actually Dave was talking about the Mars images, the worm.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to look at those, Steve?
Oh yeah.
Uh huh.
Those images are that particular image, and there's actually quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
Places where this is showing up on Mars.
One of the things that I said in my little piece there, Stephen, was I'm saying it's time for us to stop asking NASA. It's time to start making demands. Is there any way we can do that?
Well, there have been some attempts. As you know, the Abby Hoffman of the Disclosure Movement is Richard Hoagland, and he has pounded NASA pretty hard over the years. This is why He has repeatedly never been asked to the annual Christmas dinner. I don't know why.
But yeah, it comes as no surprise.
And he's dumped a lot of faxes on Golden, and he's dumped some faxes into JPL and generally raised all the issues. But it is remarkable when you think about it, and it's so easy to take this for granted. But as you know, not too long ago, the head of JPL, Malin, put 30,000, I think it's now the total is down to 60,000 photographs on the Internet. Now, you have to step back for a second. Let's all go back to 1980. We were all around then. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, well, you know, in about 20 years, there's going to be this Internet, and everybody's going to be able to just tap into it and go all over the world and see all kinds of things. They'll be able to listen, watch stuff on video streams. And by the way, there'll be 60,000 photos of Mars that they can just browse through anytime they want to. And in fact, the people that took them, NASA and the JPL, haven't really looked at them all that carefully. You might even find something on Mars that nobody's even seen before. Oh, yeah, sure, we'd have said. I know that. I was almost certain that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extraordinary time. The tunnel or worm images are just flying around the world. The URLs are being passed. There are many different versions of this. One in particular is quite startling. What is notable here, again, is that the model that I work with and have since I started this 5 years ago, got into all this business, is that we are all victims, in a sense, of history. That we're all caught in the middle of a rather amazing moment in time.
Mm.
You and I and NASA, past presidents, the members of the military, former members of the military, pilots, radar operators and air controllers, and all of us have been caught in the middle of this thing where the rules of conduct, in some cases even the rules of government, are altered, just a little, they're modified, skewed a little bit. We've entered warp space in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because the human race is not quite able to simply take this issue head on. That it's not, you know, there was 500 years ago, Columbus, representing Europe, sort of discovers the New World. He comes back, and suddenly they find out there's a New World. Well, a lot of people think that's what happened. Actually, the whole idea of the world being round, the whole idea of there being other possibilities over the oceans, have been hanging around for a long time. It was not like it just hit them, cold cocked them out of the blue. And so they adjusted to this sort of interesting new reality fairly well, and before you know it, they're sending armies to conquer a very short amount of time. This has been not good, hard for us. This has been a tough one. And as a result, we've warped space and time, and we've warped our thinking and our laws to try to get through it. Now we're 50 years into that. So I view NASA as a victim of this. I view JPL as a victim of this. And what it's really coming down to is everyone has to, in their own mind, decide whether the benefits of maintaining this, staying in this warped moment in history where things are skewed, are greater or lesser than the benefits of simply snapping things back to normal time and space and simply treating this as just part of the real world. New information to know about and deal with it straight on. That's been helpful for me, Earl, because there's a great deal of frustration in this work, as you know. You get very angry very easily.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on. You get treated funny. You don't get paid mostly. It's just very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's easy to feel victimized. It's easy to feel any number of emotions. And everybody I know pretty much gone through them all. But if you look at it that way, then it's a little easier to go along. I don't want to beat NASA up. I don't want to ruin Malin's career. I don't want to see military officers hauled in front of the press and humiliated. I don't want to see the press humiliated, even though they're going to have a lot of answers to to they got to come up with a lot of answers to a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know, we're all in this together, and
but
my decision is if we face up to it, there will be more benefits than there will be bad things.
But now you mentioned the questions here. Has anybody like put the serious questions to NASA? Has anybody said,
oh,
to NASA,
yeah,
listen, guys?
Oh yeah.
Look
they
at
have.
These glass worms. Let's have a good look at them.
No, you know, there's a group of scientists called the SPSR group, Planetary Study Research. These are scientists and engineers who, by and large, sit outside the UFO reality, the UFO community.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't part of it when they got into it. They're not part of it now.
Yeah, Stanley McDaniel was on this program a little while back.
Yeah, McDaniel is kind of in that zone, and Jack Kasher's in that zone.
Mm-hmm.
But there is kind of like a tectonic plate. Since we recently had a lot of earthquakes, let's definitely go with the tectonic plate metaphors. Got to do that. You think of the mainstream world, particularly mainstream science and the UFO community and the UFO community and UFO science, sort of there's a point where they intersect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these two plates come together, and there's a lot of friction right along that line. You've got people that are on one plate that are scared to death that somebody's going to drag them over the other side. And the people that are near the edge, kind of in calling distance, and they actually talk to the other people, but they're afraid that someone will hear them. There's a lot of that. SPSR is on one side, and you've got people like Hoagland, you've got and other people that you know well on the other. But they met with NASA a number of times. There were sort of agreements that were reached. There were semi-understandings, and they were kind of pressuring NASA in that way. Just on the basis of, I think, goodwill. Some of these people actually worked for NASA at one time. And by and large, they were betrayed, pretty much, and know that. Some of the people in that group, again, primarily focused on Mars, have suffered because of it. I mean, they've gotten pretty upset and angry, and there have been health issues. NASA's been confronted, certainly, in other ways, over the years, it's been confronted. Don Ecker was confronting them years ago over the moon anomalies. That mm-hmm. continued on through other people. Hoagland, of course, has become their nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, there's a lot of pressure, but they have generally managed to survive it. Now, understand that NASA is in the worst position of all. As an agency, as part of government, caught up in this 50-year time warp. It's in a weaker position, certainly. Obviously, the NSA doesn't have to put up with this. The CIA puts up with it a little, but not much. The DOD is virtually insulated. The military intel groups, you don't picket them. You can't get inside them. You can't challenge them. You can't confront them. They're virtually... NASA is this agency sitting out there on the side. It happens to be the agency designed to explore space.
Mm.
It is an intelligence operation, and it can't ring itself with barbed wire. So it really is there taking the hits for policies that aren't set by them. As we've talked about before, Earl, and I wrote about in a column called NASA, Thorn or Jewel in the Crown, which you can find still archived at the Alien Zoo website, alienzoo.com.
Yeah.
NASA was formed in 1958 by the National Space Act. And when you actually read the National Space Act, and in that column I have sections of the act with the key parts that people need to understand in red, you find that it's basically a civilian agency created by the United States government to explore space, except in any instance involving national security or weapons or military issues, anything like that, meaning anything that they consider national security stuff, and most people know what that means. Mm-hmm. NASA must defer completely to the Department of Defense. And they set up a thing called the National Space Council, and in the event, it actually says this in the act, in the event that there's a disagreement between the Department of Defense and NASA over something in that national security area, right, is it or is it not, or what to do about it, it's the president that's supposed to oversee, right, this dispute and sort of break the tie. Well, not too many years after the thing was set up, they eliminated that council and pretty much took the president out of it. I think that was intentional, and so basically there wasn't even a tiebreaker there. And so NASA's had to defer the DOD since the day it was born, 1958. And it's in an impossible position. So by law, it can't even talk about ETs if the DOD doesn't want it to. And so I view it, and that's one of the reasons the JPL was set up. See, it's a separate entity off to the side, which is run on the Caltech campus, which if you don't know, and when you talked about this once before, it answers to a committee at the university, at Caltech University, and lo and behold, the committee, which is a part of the board of the university, that particular committee is headed by none other than Bobby Inman, who is the most well-known, established black ops covert intelligence guy in government, in the history of the United States. He's done it and been there and done it all.
Mm.
And that's one way that they're managing to sort of keep the lid on this for so long. And so the agency is literally trapped between the DOD and the entire cover-up and the rest of the world. And so technically, we could beat the crap out of it.
So basically what we've got is we've got NASA being a scapegoat.
Well, it's more than that. It's a scapegoat, but it's also a functionary in the cover-up because it has to defer. Its mission is warped. I mean, obviously, if you're a scientist and anything turns up in your world that has ET implications, and you're supposed to say, well, you know, say nothing, shut up. That's going to be referred over to DOD. You will do nothing. You will say nothing. If anybody talks about it, doesn't exist. You're going to be very unhappy about that. And so you got a lot of unhappy people over there. When they do good things, they're still not given, you know, full credit because of this. They're in a very tough spot. And I think one of the best reasons then to cover up is to free this agency, you know, free NASA. You know, let it be NASA. Let it explore space. Use that money wisely. That's one real immediate instant benefit we get from ending this silly 50-year cover-up.
John joins us on the line. John, good evening and welcome. Say hello to Steve Bassett and Dave Verlot.
Stephen, a couple of questions. You know, the one comment I do have is the, you know, with all the secrecy that's going on right now, I think that the governments could still do their research on UFOs or on the flying saucers that they do have right now, you know, in their clutches, without having the secrecy. I mean, they, you know, if like they're doing work on the hydrogen bombs right now to miniaturize them, and you know, we know about them. The second thing I've got is, you know, with this Mars photo, you've got like a Trojan horse right now. And have you approached the major newspapers as a way of directing the will of the people?
Apparently, Graham says we've lost Stephen. We will try and get him back. The press, I would think, he'd be back?
I'd be back.
Oh, you'll be back. Good. Mm-hmm. Welcome back. I guess you missed the question. John, our caller, was asking if the current worm image, which, by the way, is available to you, the listener, surf over to www.enterprisemission.com. John was asking if the image that we're talking about, the worm image, well, there are a bunch of them, have been presented to the press.
Not in a formal way. I think that is going to happen. I think that's inevitable. The debate on these, of course, are going to mature a lot further. There's already been some semi-official responses. James Oberg, I think, is come out with some comments, and also Bernard Hayes had an interchange with David Perry, I think his name is.
Now, James Oberg has always been the skeptical spokesperson for NASA. What did he have to say about the worm?
I'm speculating here. I don't know specifically.
Okay.
I think he had something to say that along the same lines that David Perry had to say to Bernard Hayes, who was on the internet as well,
mm-hmm.
that it's sand dunes accumulating along narrow riverbeds.
Mm.
This is an interesting point, understand, getting back to what we were saying before the break.
Mm.
The principal way that NASA has dealt with its dilemma is, not surprisingly, to say as little as possible.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, NASA simply doesn't comment. And they've had to do a lot of things to do that. For instance, you save up those photographs and you dump 30,000 on the internet at once. Well, obviously it's hard to comment on 30,000 photographs. In fact, you can almost say, gee, well, we actually haven't even looked at the 30,000 photographs yet. That's going to take some time. So if something turns up there, they can say, well, gee, you know, we just hadn't gotten to it.
Yeah.
And clearly, I think we would all agree that in a real world, without this warping that we talked about, if a group of scientists working for a large money to discover space were to come across images like the worm and other images that have been up there, even some of the heavy analysis of the face, in a real world, there would be a lot of speculation and a lot of intense interest, and we wouldn't necessarily have a full consensus. But there would be a lot of excitement, and people would be wanting to know what to do next and maybe gearing missions around it. But, of course, that doesn't happen. NASA virtually will say nothing. If not pressed, I think it's a reasonable thing to say that if there had not been a lot of pressure applied, NASA would have never responded or had anything to say in a formal way about STS-48, STS-80, some of the moon anomalies images, of which there have been numerous.
STS-48, among the other shuttles, some alleged UFO footage from there.
Right.
And John, thank you for your call. Steve, we have about 2.5 minutes. I don't know if we've left you enough time to cover anything that you might want to talk about tonight.
I think that what we're talking about tonight is good enough, more than good enough.
Mm-hmm.
As these images continue to get more play and spread around, there will be possibly some developments out of this. NASA, I believe now, they're, as the disclosure train has been slowly leaving the station for the last couple of years, I think NASA's role has been, they decided, okay, we won't say, we'll kind of say little, hold our ground, we'll get some announcements out as we look at this life issue in the Mars rocks, which is a nice, safe thing to do. We'll let people look at these photographs, and we'll just sort of let this stuff sort of bubble up and, in a way, almost be publicly driven. I was talking to a couple of the SPSR people the other day, and I think the indication was that the total number of photographs now of Mars out of MGS is 80,000.
Oh.
And that people who care have maybe looked at this point at only about 4,000 of that 80,000.
Unbelievable.
There's still 76,000 photographs that have not been reviewed that are up on the net right now. 76,000. I think there's sort of a process going on. There's a dance going on here where NASA is one of the dance participants, and it has certain limitations in the way it can move. And the public is in the dance, and people like you and I and some of the research in the dance. And the whole idea is that we're going to sort of work our way around this dance floor until eventually the music will stop and somebody's going to go up the microphone and we're going to move on here. And it's a little odd. It's a little strange. I mean, there's a lot of strange things going on. One of the things this week of note is John Glenn's appearance on Fraser. That's all over the internet.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about that a little later on.
Sure, I'm sure your listeners will want to hear about that.
Yep.
Arthur C. Clarke has suddenly made a rather strong statement out of Sri Lanka, amazingly in the presence of Buzz Aldrin, coincidentally, who happened to be flying through. There's a dance going on here which hopefully is leading to normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
My role as a lobbyist and an activist is to sort of speed it along and get there sooner than later, and then hopefully help to maintain some normalcy after the fact, so we don't spiral back into more bizarreness as we try to deal with this new reality, this new exciting, wonderful reality.
More bizarreness. It becomes more and more bizarre every day, Stephen G. Bassett.
is that not good for anybody running a show called Strange Days?
Indeed, yes. Hey, you're going to come back and join us next week. We're doing a special next week, which we will get into next week. Stephen G. Bassett, thank you, sir. A UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. You're Earl very quickly.
Oh, yes. www.paradigmclock.com and xpac-ppac.org.
And if you need those numbers, just give us those Earls, give us a call here during the week. Dave Frelott, thank you, sir.
No problem.
Our guest is a legend in the serious study of UFO phenomena, a very well-respected researcher amongst his peers. And in fact, wherever or whenever 10 most credible ufologists list is published, Richard Hall's name is prominent. Richard is a former assistant director and acting director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, and in that capacity was editor of the 200,000-word documentary report, The UFO Evidence, and consultant to the University of Colorado UFO Project, sponsored by the American Air Force Office of Scientific Research. He's a former editor of the MUFON Journal and past chairman of UFO Research Coalition, UFORC. Richard's UFO-related publication credits include a 1968 Encyclopedia Britannica Book of the Year article, the introduction and epilogue in the 1968 Prentice Hall book Mysteries of the Skies, UFOs in Perspective. He edited the book UFO Evidence and several articles in a major appendix with a byline in the 1980 Doubleday Encyclopedia of UFOs. His 1988 Uninvited Guests, A Documented History of UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and Cover-Ups, is a book that's sure to be found on the bookshelves of most people who are seriously interested in this UFO phenomena. And his latest book, The UFO Evidence Volume 2, A 30-Year Report, published by Scarecrow Press, was officially released last month, and it's available in stores now and has been much anticipated by the research community. The UFO Evidence Volume 2, A 30-Year Report, reports 30 years of UFO sightings since 1964 with related data and descriptive features organized by category. Ooh. Now, in the course of his career in and around Washington, D.C., Richard Hall has interacted with members of Congress, administration officials, employees of national intelligence agencies, the Washington Press Corps, international agencies such as the United Nations, and foreign diplomatic missions in the U.S. And thus, his views on the UFO subject are drawn from a very broad background of knowledge and experience. Joining us from his home, I bet you thought we'd never get here, Richard, from his home in Brentwood, Maryland, is our guest, Richard Hall. Welcome back to the program, Richard.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here. You spent years both observing and writing about UFOs, the people who either research and investigate UFOs or talk publicly about them. And you've recently subscribed to my email list, UFO Updates, and after, I understand, reading the list's archives at UFOmind.com for quite a long time.
Yes, I was lurking in the background, monitoring it for quite a while.
Yeah, what's your impression of the current state of ufology, Dick?
Well, I think your net kind of reflects it very strongly. There's some very bright and aware people that are involved, and then there are people with almost a religious fervor about the subject that throw themselves into it, and there's some people who, to be kind, are sort of out in left field somewhere. So,
and some of them are not out in left field, but very much in your face too.
Oh yeah, oh sure. Well, that comes with the territory.
I think, and it's something that we mentioned many times on this program, I think that's the result of nobody having gone to school or to university or gotten any kind of degree in this field.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is potentially an expert,
yes,
at least in their own mind.
Yeah, there are no independent professional standards. Me and my colleagues have talked about that for years, and tried to institute, some substitute for that at least, where there were some kind of standards. But basically, he and my colleagues that think the same way I do about science and UFOs feel that we should apply the critical standards of science and the ethical and be civil and discuss this thing and try to hash out what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. excuse me. I try and maintain a modicum of civility, being the moderator of the list.
And you take some flack too, I notice.
Yes, I do. But
You know, I think the thing that diffuses that a lot is just by not, you know, not responding.
Yes.
You know, I think when somebody gets in your face and you respond, then that's what turns into what they call on the internet a flame war.
Or, yes, or, you know, respond, but don't respond with a flame war. You know, just
but
ease it off or respond in a kind way or whatever. You don't have to. You know, if somebody snaps in your face, you don't have to snap back necessarily.
No, but what is interesting is that since you signed on officially as a subscriber to the list, things have cooled down a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A voice of sanity out there.
Well, I hope
a voice of experience.
I hope there's more than one. We're in trouble.
Oh, no. Well, there are a lot, but I think when the name Richard Hall comes onto UFO updates, everybody pays attention because it's a name that's well respected in this field.
Well, I appreciate that.
And you've certainly, you know, paid your dues and done the work, and there's a lot of respect for you. So this is good. Oh, where. With your book now, with your new book, that's filled in the blanks since what,
1964 was the first UFO evidence, and this one covers approximately 30 years since then, a little more than that actually, but primarily 30 years, and that's a lot of data. It was a relearning experience. Research it, because no single individual, no matter how involved in this subject, has a good overview of it, because there are no daily news reports about it. You know, there's no single journal that covers everything. So when I began researching it, I was surprised myself about how much had gone on in the past 30 years, and I pulled it all together in here, and I was surprised how many good sightings there had been by professional pilots and police officers and solid citizens and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled it all together in there and laid it out, and I hope, pray, that it has some kind of good effect on things.
The professionals in the past who made reports of UFO sightings, have many of their careers suffered as a result of doing that?
Good heavens, yes. As you may recall, in recent days, there's been complaints from one of the people on the list about suffering from being involved in this subject. Well, I've suffered from being involved in the subject tremendously myself, but I'm not complaining about that. That was my choice, but I'm well aware from decades of interviewing people that professionals who have spoken out on this subject have paid a terrible price, and their careers have been hurt, and that's just about every field, and that's why you don't hear more from scientists.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if there are scientists listening right now, they know what I'm talking about. They can have a sighting, but they're not going to report it, you know, and I don't blame them, because they're going to be flamed. Talk about flamed, and who's going to flame them? Their own colleagues.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be other people. It's going to be skeptical, scoffing scientists who flame them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the classic example was a couple of years back, and this is a name that comes up on this program often, is John Mack.
Yes.
And the troubles that he went through.
Yes. And James McDonald before him, and Dave Jacobs, the terrible price at Temple University, and on and on and on. There are lots of scientists and other professionals, and I've talked to airline pilots. They've paid a price. You know, their companies tell them, shut up, don't talk about this, we'll lose business. And, you know, it goes on and on. There's a tremendous ridicule factor here that people don't take into account. And they wonder, why aren't there reports from these people? Well, my goodness, I know very well why there aren't reports from people in these groups, because this sort of thing happens. And this ridicule has to end. I mean, there's no excuse for it. Ridicule is not science.
Sage words, Richard. We need to break here. We will come back with more of Richard Hall and all kinds of interesting conversation. If you want to join in, please feel free to do so by email SDI, as in Strange Days Indeed, SDI at CFRB.com. 416-872-1010. Star Talk on your mobile. That's star 8255. Or outside of Toronto, it's a free local call. 1-800-561-CFRB if you're in Ontario. Strange Days Indeed. We'll continue with Richard Hall on News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010.
Color Your World, spring is all about color, and that means great savings. Right now is the perfect time to save at all the paint, paper, window coverings, and floor coverings you want during Color Your World Spring is All About Color event. Save up to 40% on Designer's Touch Interior Latex Paint. Save 40% on all wallpaper book orders. Plus, check out the new arrivals in our Design Studio wallpaper and border collection. Don't miss the Spring is All About Color event at Color Your World. And visit our website at coloryourworld.com.
I'm a pharmacist, and people are always coming into the pharmacy to ask me what kind of vitamin C they should take.
Elaine Cunningham, pharmacist, Elmhurst, New York.
When it comes to vitamin C, the answer is simple. I always recommend Ester C. Vitamin C helps maintain your bones and cartilage and teeth and gums. And Ester C is a premium vitamin C. It's pure, patented, non-acidic, and of natural source. I tell my customers, make sure your vitamin C says Ester C on the label.
Look for Sisu Ester C wherever supplements are sold.
The International Home and Garden Show returns March 15th to 18th to the International Center. Discover thousands of renovation ideas and great gardening products. Experience the decorating challenge in the Harrow Smith Do-It-Yourself Theater. Explore the Success with Gardening Show for free. Discover what's hot in the Outdoor Living Pavilion. Enter to win a $10,000 in-ground swimming pool from Pioneer Family Pools. Don't miss the International Home and Garden Show, March 15th to 18th at the International Center, where smart people shop and park for free.
Activate computer file. Access chat room. Search for stimulating talk. Download file. News Talk Radio in 3, 2, 1. Download complete.
CFRB 1010.
Hi, I'm Dale Curry of the Toronto Raptors. On the court, every member of the team can make a difference. It's the same in life. Covenant House, Canada's largest shelter for homeless kids, offers help and hope to thousands of youth every year. As well as giving kids a safe place to stay and a good meal, Covenant House provides education and job assistance to help kids get a jump on the future. To do all of this, Covenant House needs your support. Make a difference. Call 1-800-HELP-308.
A message from the station that cares, CFRB 1010.
Strange Days Indeed is the name of the program. My name is Earl Bruce. The objective of the program is to inform you about things that you normally don't get informed about in the regular media, in the press. Not in any kind of detail, anyway. Not without a mention of Little Green Man, tee-hee, the giggle factor. Our guest is Richard Hall, who will be speaking together with Bud Hopkins about UFOs and abductions at a seminar in New York City on April 21st, sponsored by the Intruders Foundation. And you can find event info at www.intrudersfoundation.org. That's www.intrudersfoundation.org. We spend a fair amount of time, Richard, on this program because John Velez is a regular on the program, and there seems to be a lot of interest and a lot of people who maintain that they have been taken, abducted by strange beings. There are several ufologists out there who figure that we should not be looking at that at all as UFO researchers, but we should stay focused on the UFOs and only the unidentified flying objects. How do you feel about that?
Well, first I have to say that John Velez is one of my favorite people, and I'm very sympathetic to his cause, and I'm not one of those who says you can afford to ignore this. In fact, in my new book, new volume of the UFO evidence, there's extensive coverage of the whole abduction phenomenon and how it evolved out of the background of general UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
Try to give some insight into that.
Yeah.
And I have spent a lot of personal time talking with and interviewing and dealing with, I call them victims because I think they are victims. There are some people who disagree with that. But so I'm well aware of the phenomena. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult and messy and hard to investigate, but you can't ignore it for that reason. And yeah. the people are hurting, they're suffering, and you have to take that into account, and I take into account very seriously.
And when you when I think about it, you know, it's an explanation for the phenomena that we that are being reported in the skies every day, 24 hours a day now with the internet. I mean, the number of sightings around the planet is staggering.
Yes.
And it's the only explanation that anybody has come up with is these things are relating to certain members of our society, in a not very pleasant way.
Yes.
Which is, an email here from, Michel Deschamps in Sudbury. Richard, I bought and read your book, Uninvited Guests, and I really enjoyed it. Excellent work. Heard about your new one, and he's looking forward to it being available up there. The new one, of course, being the UFO Evidence Volume 2, a 30-year report. Michelle continues, there's a desperate need to present historical UFO events to those who are not aware of this particular part of our history. And experienced researchers like Donald Keough and yourself have done that and are still doing it. Thank you for your dedication to this field. We need more people like you.
Well, that's very nice. I appreciate that.
Yeah, because of the length of time that you've been involved in this field, and you basically, when did you actually start? When did your interest bring you into working in this field in ufology?
I first formally started in 1958. I had been informally involved from about 1954. So it's been close to 50 years.
Mm.
While I was going to university in New Orleans, I published a newsletter on the subject and started getting in touch with other people who were active in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. and got involved with NICAP.
And who in the field that you work with, past or present, impressed you the most?
Oh, well, hands down, James McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
He was my good friend and idol, my role model. He's the
for our
professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Arizona,
mm.
and set very high standards for the rest of us. Another one I admire very much, who's no longer active, but I'm still in touch with him, is Ted Blocher in New York City, who also has very high standards of research, and there's Bruce McAbee and Dick Haynes and a lot of good people
mm-hmm.
active in the field.
Mm. I won't even ask you there. Well, let's not go there. I was going to say, and who don't you like in the field?
Oh, I could talk about that for hours.
but without naming names, but dropping broad enough hints so that most of us recognize who you were talking about.
Yeah. I could do it without naming names. I think the people who have obvious axes to grind or out to make a joke or a game out of it or to profiteer on it or... To hassle other people, you know, these kind of people. And the New Agers, I don't have, I'm well known for this. I got attacked for that recently, as you know, but
mm-hmm.
I do not appreciate what they're doing to the field because they're giving the whole field a bad name. And these are not evil people by any means. I mean, I know people who hold some so-called, quote-unquote, New Age beliefs, and they can be very nice, sweet people. But I still think they're wrong in their approach to the subject, and when they commandeer it and stuff it in together with all kinds of other weird off-the-wall ideas, it just cheapens the whole field to me. I cannot go along with that.
Mm.
And I know that's controversial, but that's what I believe.
Well, no, and it's absolutely legitimate, too. mind you, maybe these New Agers are in touch with the benevolent beings that they maintain they're in touch with. I mean, who knows? I mean, it could be as real as, you know, as people like Velez who are taken and have terrible things done to them physically.
Velez is a very, very rational person. I'm very impressed mm-hmm. by when he ever posts it. Whenever he posts on there, I usually look at and read.
Yeah. He's actually on the program a little later on tonight.
Oh, good.
He and Greg Sandow.
Greg Sandow is another person I admire very
right.
much.
Yes. Yeah. A message here from Wendy Connors for your great work on UFO evidence too, Dick. What direction do you see ufology taking in the next few years?
First of all, I'd like to say hi, Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
She lurks around on the list, too, and watches what's going on.
Yeah,
I don't know if she admits that.
And she has her ears on her computer, too, on the web. she's almost inevitably, she's out there every Saturday night.
She mentioned that both she and I are featured in a forthcoming French TV2 documentary, which is a pretty high-level thing over there.
Yeah, well, there you blew my out to the next commercial break.
Oh, sorry about that.
No,
well, I'll say
okay.
no more. say no more.
But seriously, Dick, what direction do you see ufology taking in the next few years?
Well, it's easier to say what I hope the direction will be.
Okay.
Because I really, you know, it's so unpredictable. But I'd like to use as one example this very recent news report, I didn't hear it directly, that John Glenn, our famous astronaut,
mm-hmm.
allegedly said that they saw all kinds of things and were instructed not to talk about it.
That's an interesting, he was on the Frasier show.
Mm-hmm. Now, to me, the big issue is, mm-hmm. where are the investigative reporters of the world?
Mm.
Why is this filtered only through UFO partisans? Why doesn't the Washington Post or New York Times or Toronto newspapers or whatever get on this?
I think my feeling was, Dick, that was done with tongue
okay.
firmly planted
well,
in
that
cheek.
Would explain it if mm-hmm. that's the case. Now, I didn't see that, so
yeah.
I can't comment.
Really, I mean, it was very clever. Roz and Frasier were having a battle. Roz, do you watch the program?
Yes, I do, on occasion.
Roz had a special assignment to produce a documentary on space. Frasier was going to narrate it. Frasier got his usual Frasier self and upset Roz. She felt he was trying to take over. So she fired Frasier off the project and brought in John Glenn. Right. So Glenn is sitting in the green room waiting to go into the studio and do his narration for the space documentary, and Frasier comes in and says, look, I got a couple of ideas. I was going to narrate, yada, yada, but here's my ideas. But don't tell Roz that it was me. You know, just say it was your idea. So they get into the studio, and this whole thing goes down where Roz suddenly discovers that it's Frasier who gave Glenn the ideas after he pitched her, and Frasier and Roz go into the control room to have it out with the monitor in the control room turned down, and Glenn sits there and more or less talking to the microphone himself. And being upset because he was called dishonest by Roz, says, I'm not really a dishonest man, and I hate all of these, you know, all of these things that they made us do. He says things like, it's my nature to be honest, and, you know, back in those glory days, I was very uncomfortable when they asked us to say things that I didn't want to say and deny other things. And some people ask, you know, were you alone out there? And we never gave the real answer, and yet we've seen things out there, strange things.
Mm-hmm.
And it continues. And periodically you cut to the into the control room, and you see Glenn sitting through the glass, describing aliens with his forefingers wiggling on his forehead, doing antennae, and taking his thumb and forefinger and putting it on his forehead like a, you know, an eye in the middle of the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And he's having a wonderful time. I mean, you know, there was no sense that he was acting.
Okay.
He was just having a blast.
Yeah.
Making fun of all of the people that have said all of the things about all of the astronauts who allegedly saw things.
All right.
Well,
that puts it in an entirely different light.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, let me put it another way, then. I still feel that there are lots of things going on where the investigative reporters are just falling down on the job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And newspapers are just not digging into it, and I hope at least I'll provide them some ammunition with my new book. But it is, it's a very sad thing, and until we get them to pay attention, and science, is that's a tough nut to crack, but hopefully we make some inroads there. So I hope that gradually as we go along, we will make a more persuasive case that there are serious things going on here that people should pay attention to, but I can only hope that. I can't predict it will ever happen.
Mm-hmm. We were talking in the first hour on the program, Dick, about the Mars worm image.
Oh yeah, I'm very intrigued by that.
With Stephen Bassett, he of the you know, the UFO lobbyist in Washington, Stephen G. Bassett, and Dave Furlott, both of whom are on the list. And Bassett was, you know, we were, somebody had, I think it was, somebody had called him John, I think, and asked if the press had gotten a hold of that picture yet, you know, had it been presented to the press?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, Bassett didn't think so. The thing is, what I don't understand is why, when there are, you know, when there's a radio station like this, and then there's Rents, and then there's, the, you know, the others that do these radio programs, why the remainder of the media aren't picking up on some of this. I mean, some of it is just nonsense, but there's, you know, when you can go on the web and take 2 minutes and go find that image and take a look at it and then start and ask questions.
Yes.
Why isn't anybody doing that?
They seem to be incapable of, well, this is one of my complaints about why I'm so upset about the subject being confused with other things. It's a curse. The image of the UFO field is horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tabloid image. We're all
tinfoil hats and loonies.
We're all we're all National Examiners, and you know, there's no solid basis to it. That's unfortunately the image. And so when they hear people talking about it or presenting, it's just more of that nonsense. And that's, you know, you have to get around that. And to my way of thinking, the way you get around that is by being very tough on the people who are messing up the field in that way, and, and stick to facts and stick to hard evidence and make a strong effort to differentiate yourself from the people who are muddying up the waters like that.
Well, we try and do that here, and I think largely we succeed. I was talked into having one New Ager on the program back in the first year, and it was really uncomfortable. It was embarrassing. You know, I mean, it's just. There are several people out there, I mean, not so much in the field anymore, but there was one in particular who would just start talking and not stop, and you could not get an edge in word-wise. and just, you know, just lay so much information on you, whether it was pertinent or not, that you were just knocked over by this barrage of words that, in actual fact, didn't mean anything.
Well, there you go, There are people like that who just—it's just an outpouring of something. You should be able. I mean, I'm not referring to you personally, but people need to learn to distinguish between New Agers or people who are giving this kind of outpouring and people who are making some kind of sense, who are arguing with facts and logic, presenting hard evidence. That's what. The kind of distinction that needs to be made by people out there, and particularly by the people who could make a difference, the scientists and the investigative journalists and so forth.
Well, that's one good thing that about the book that David Jacobs edited.
I have that sitting in my lap right now. I've just been reading it.
It's a darn good read. We had David Jacobs and the executive Michael Briggs, who was the responsible for, you know, largely responsible for pitching that book to was it Kansas University Press?
I've been telling some friends and colleagues about this book because I was surprised. I had it sitting here for a while before I started reading it, and it's a very impressive, very philosophical, very thoughtful book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I highly recommend it. I wish a lot of people would read it.
Yeah, would you UFOs and abductions?
UFOs and abductions, edited by David M. Jacobs, subtitled Challenging the Borders of Knowledge.
And not only an academic tome, but a wonderful history book, too.
Yes, it is. Of course, David Jacobs was the first to write a serious history overview of the subject, too, before in his PhD thesis, his previous book.
Do we have time for a call here, Graham? We have time for a call? Okay, just to interrupt the flow, we're going all over the place here, Richard. I want to bring Carrie into the conversation.
Oh, hello, Harold.
Good evening, Carrie.
I'm glad you hit another nerve, my friend. I went down to see the IMAX Theater Scientist at the Science Center down on Don Mills there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Solar Max, the sun and everything. Well, there was a pretty, well, everybody said we'd like to give you her phone number. A very pretty young astronomer came out. You'd love the date. Anyone would. So I went down and I waited a long time about my questions because, as you said, the other chap there, fear, you know?
Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when the fear, so I brought everything up. We talked about this and I said, well, what do you think about other solar systems away? And yes, other solar systems have planets. And we got talking and I thought, well, now I'll let the bomb off. There's only 7 people, not 700.
Mm.
What about life on other planets, the way things, she mentioned Einstein's theory. I said, what about UFOs? Not that I'm being funny, but do you know what their rate? She applauded me digging into all this knowledge that I was talking to her about on the spiritual end and everything, not being that what you were saying, but whether there was a God or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so here's the thing she said. First of all, she said they're so far away that to try and get here would take too long in our lifetime. Well, okay. And the second reason, she said, is we would have seen some of them. Well, I was going to start talking about what they'd seen, but, you know, I didn't want to be laughed out. She was applauding me. But we can go to the University of Toronto, their David Dunlop Observatory. They still have tours up there and sessions. And I just said, well, we can't even explain life. What is life? As Kreskin said when on one of his shows, you've heard of that now. He's just for entertainment, but some people have lost limbs, and they woke up in the operating room still saying they felt them.
Yeah.
Yet when you photograph them with infrared light, she said, I know. And do you know what really kind of sent me? You know when you get that feeling, Harold?
Carrie.
Yeah?
Do you have a question for Richard?
Yeah. The thing is what I was going to verify, when I told her all about this.
Carrie.
Yeah?
Do you have a question for Richard?
Yeah.
Would you ask it, please?
Well, I agree.
Please, Carrie.
Yeah.
Please ask your question of Richard, and then we can move on. Okay.
Richard.
Time is precious.
Oh yeah, Richard. Do you think it's because people are frightened to really talk about this? They're, you know, it's just that you go so far and you bounce off the. That's the limit of knowledge. We can't go any further.
I think there's a certain fear in the sense that if you accept this as real, then you're in a lot of trouble because it affects our whole scientific theories and outlook on life. And that astronomer, you ought to tell her to read my book.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, Dave Jacobs' book.
Dave Jacobs' book, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for your call, Carrie. Thank you for your patience, Richard. We make our way toward midnight. Richard Hall is our guest. Now, Richard was leading into a French documentary about UFOs in which he and Wendy A. Connors feature in, which showed in France this last month, and will air, it will air in France next month in prime time. And then presumably, Dick, the North American release will come sometime this summer.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing that one, too. Richard, you have a website, which I love the painting there. It has nothing to do with UFOs, but I was looking at it today. It's gorgeous.
Yes.
Yes. done by, and it, as I said, it has nothing to do with UFOs, but it was done by someone who is handicapped and painted this amazing.
Yes, as an association of mouse and hand painting artists, handicap artists.
Oh.
And they do marvelous work.
Yep. And the Richard's website, not only the painting, but the UFOs and related things, is at triple dub
Paul Richard. That's the reverse of, but probably because there are other Richard Halls
exactly
out there.
Exactly right.
Do a search for Richard Hall. It's quite remarkable. HallRichard.com. Go there, take a look, and admire this man's career in this field. It's
Richard Hall was taken. That's why I couldn't get that one.
Well, pretty soon we're going to have .UFOs as well, I think, you know, and that'll be an interesting. You sent an interesting email, Dick, to UFO updates, attaching for, well, you put offered to various websites a two-pager called Conceptualizing UFOs.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we can take a couple of minutes and talk about that.
Sure.
A little bit.
Yes, I'm very pleased. I've gotten 10 or 15 responses from all over the world now, amazingly. I think it's just sort of a very simple concept to pull together where we stand and how we ought to be dealing with the subject, and it defines some terms and, you know, it tells where we stand on the subject and how do we make progress from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we need to do is focus and work together, all of those who think there's something going on, whether they are skeptical or not about its nature, to just pull together and work on it and forget the extremists.
Mm-hmm. A scoffer, as you describe, you sort of categorized people a bit. A scoffer would not be an extremist, in your view.
Yes, a scoffer would be an extremist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, a scoffer would be. The scoffers and the believers are the two extremes in which I define the terms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a believer in UFOs, but I don't like that term.
No.
And I give a very specialized meaning to that. It's the ones who are very uncritical and think everything that flies overhead is a visiting spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
The way I use believer.
The skeptic has become a pejorative in the last few, the last 10, 15 years.
I think most of us are skeptics, really. I mean, and as somebody said to me in an email response to that posting, it's a good way to put it, because we're neither believers nor disbelievers. We are curious-minded, interested parties trying to get to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the good, legitimate meaning of the term skeptic.
Well, you also you mentioned in the same paragraph that the term skeptic has been preempted by the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, PSYCOP.
Right.
But you say it would be a more accurate use of the term in its historical sense, where PSYCOP members tend to be either scoffers or debunkers.
Yes.
And there doesn't appear, and this is something we talk about fairly regularly on this program too, there doesn't appear to be a lot of science in the work of the critics of ufology in PSYCOP.
No, definitely not. I don't want to paint them with a tar brush like they do us, because there are individual members and board members who are very sensible, intelligent people, but they let the scoffers do their work for them. They don't do independent thinking about it, whereas, as Jerry Clark and others have pointed out, in our field, we're highly critical of each other.
Yes.
You know, we have a lot of self-criticism going on, which is good. That's peer review.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's no adjudication committee at the end of it. No, it just,
probably just as well. But
well, yeah, probably. We have a few minutes left together, Dick. Have we covered most of the ground that you feel we need to cover? Or, you know, in the last couple of minutes, do you have something that you'd like to address?
Well, it's such a broad field. I really think that people will be surprised to see how much has been going on in the past 30 years. As I said briefly, it surprised even me, because the conventional news media don't report it. And I think people need to do some homework, as you suggest. Get on the internet and do a little searching and winnow your way through into the more serious materials, and you will be surprised at what you find on there.
Mm-hmm.
And more so, even in the bookstores, if you use a little judgment about which books you buy, you'll learn a lot. But there's got to be a more critical process of weeding this stuff out. By the way, I won a little minor battle most UFO books in modern times are in the New Age or occult section of bookstores.
Yes.
I fought with Scarecrow Press about that. And if you look on the back cover of my book, now it says science. That was a minor victory.
Well, that's good. What's really interesting up here is one of the large chains bookstores here, Indigo Books, have a section that's labeled UFOs.
Oh, no, that's good.
And it's in the spiritual and the psychology and in that sort of, you know, New Age area, but it's not on the New Age shelf.
Yeah.
And it's just so odd that nothing has been done about that. Authors like you, have to, you know, pound the table and say, look, you know, you're not paying me anything for my damn book. At least put it under science and not New Age.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the problem with the field. You know, it's again, an illustration of how it's been submerged under craziness, you know.
Well,
this is just human craziness.
Yes, yes. Ignored because we're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. But we have a Saturday night program, and this is program 124 here on the biggest AM station in Canada, basically.
Well, I think you're doing a real service with UFO updates, I have to say that.
I started out in radio, and when I was running my little Atari-based BBS here in Toronto and suddenly got made it pop through to the Internet, and there was nowhere for people like us to go.
Mm-hmm.
Me as the seriously interested civilian, and you as the man who's been doing it for all of these years, and that's what I tried to do with updates, was to, you know, make a place where it was relatively safe to go and discuss things, mm-hmm. you know, and try to maintain that.
Well, I think you have a pretty good bunch there, a good clientele.
Great clientele. I mean, the subscribers are wonderful. The great majority of them. You know,
I'm impressed even by the ones that are more skeptical. They're very sensible, most of them.
So mm-hmm.
have
mm-hmm.
no complaints at all. That's good.
Yeah. And I think it'll only get better as more and more people become interested and start to look into things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to mention Dick's website, the URL is hallrichard.com. People can send you email through that website, too.
Yes, they can.
Oh, good. Okay. And, the book is The UFO Evidence, Volume 2. A 30-year report. I have as I get older, my memory just fades away.
Welcome to the club.
Oh. It's not a club I really wanted to join, but, you know, there are no options anymore.
Right.
Richard, thank you for your time. Listen, I had mentioned to you a while ago, you know, being a monthly contributor to the program, and I'd like to reoffer that to you now that things are sorted out and organized a little more. Would you care to come and spend a half an hour a month with us, or 40 minutes or something?
Hey, once a month? Yeah, I could do that.
That would be wonderful. I hate to ask you on air, but I, you know.
Oh, that's fine. I'd be glad to do that once a month.
Okay. That'll be, we'll talk about it in the next few days.
All right.
Thank you, Richard Hall, and good luck with the book, and good luck with all of the things that you're into, and I hope that together, all of us can make a difference.
Thank you very much.
Good night, Dick.
Good night.
Thank you. We're going down to New York City right now. Joining us is a Renaissance man. He writes classical music reviews for the Wall Street Journal, articles for other publications, including the Los Angeles Times, Opera News, and the Village Voice. He's a member of the graduate studies faculty at Juilliard, teaching two courses, music criticism and classical music in an age of pop. He's a composer. He's currently working on his fifth opera. Greg Sando does much consulting, public speaking, radio broadcasts, chairs panel discussions for a variety of organizations, including the Lincoln Center, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Opera America, the American Symphony Orchestra League, where he did an all-day workshop on how to talk about music. There's a man who would know.
And the Scottsdale Center for the Arts, the Voice of America, New York Kids, a New York radio show in which he taught kids to be music critics, and the New York State Council on the Arts. He's director of online content and planning for MusicMaker.com, an internet company that sells custom CD compilations. And in addition to all this, he has what seems to be an immense fascination in things ufological, the phenomena of UFOs. He's been interested in UFOs since he was a kid. As a UFO-minded adult, he has worked closely with Bud Hopkins and currently serves on Bud's advisory committee, where Greg helps to help, well, Greg works to help Bud Hopkins develop his Intruders Foundation. And as Dick Hall said earlier on, Richard Hall, he's an interesting addition to the UFO updates list. Greg, welcome back to the program.
I am absolutely breathless hearing about myself. I'm going to have to take off my tinfoil hat.
Yeah, well, make sure it's off because it makes funny rustling sounds against the handset.
You know, it attracts alien vibration. You know, one thing I have to correct about the biography, which is I have to probably correct the source you got it from, too. It sounds like my website.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I knew you were out doing a review this evening, and when I was putting this together, I thought, oh, well, Greg's
website. A very smart thing to do. So I have to put on the website that MusicMaker.com has gone the way of all .coms.
Oh, no.
And no longer exists.
Yeah, well, who needed them anyway?
I liked the paycheck, but otherwise, apparently,
yeah, apparently
the world felt who needed them.
Yes, exactly. It's really sad, the way things are going down for a lot of people, and it's really unfortunate that you stopped getting one of your paychecks. So I apologize for my facetiousness.
That's okay, and that's obviously why I came on the show, because of this fine paycheck you're offering me. Now,
yeah.
I'll give you
10% of the fine paycheck that I get. That should make you about $7.50.
Well, one other footnote I want to say, just because I'm so proud, I was actually out tonight with my wife, who is reviewing something. I married her in October, and she married me. We're newlyweds, and she has become a classical music critic for the New York Times.
Congratulations to both of you, and your wife on becoming the classical music critic for the New York Times. Boy, what a team you must be. Formidable, do you...
And we're both 6 feet tall.
Yeah. are you both reviewing the same programs?
It's never happened, but this was her night. Beyond the aisle, and my night to be the companion.
Now, I want to come back to UFOs, because I think I've done an admirable job of taking up at least a half of the half hour you committed to doing this program tonight. So, we were talking with Dick Hall for the last hour, and
there is a good man.
Oh, a lovely man, and just what a wealth of experience and schmarts as far as a lot of this is concerned. He had put the labels and communication thread together on UFO updates. And was it Confronting UFOs, or?
I don't recall what he called it.
I will tell you what he called it. He called it Conceptualizing UFOs.
Conceptualizing.
And he had made several suggestions, which we started to get into in the last 10 minutes of his hour. And you had responded, and I thought... you know, you don't post a lot, but what you do is really very much to the point and very sensible, Greg Sando.
Well, thank you so much, Dick, too. I think Dick has a wonderful way of, in the fewest possible words, saying a great deal, saying it fairly, clearly, and strongly.
Mm-hmm.
He is something else.
Yes.
So you
posted I'm sorry?
Yeah, I did. I'm just going along with you.
Yeah, you did. You posted some, because Dick had invited responses.
Mm-hmm.
And you said this is a very interesting and worthwhile effort, which can only lead to clarity.
Yeah, Dick had put out a list of terms that we often hear in UFO debate.
Yeah, we had talked about it.
You talked about it. So I don't have to go over
some of them. But he introduced some interestings too. The which we didn't get to talk about, which was the doubter, who tends to think that UFO reports probably have mundane explanations for the most part, but finds the reports interesting and worth studying.
You know, I didn't respond to that when I put my post up. That's mm-hmm. interesting. I'd forgotten all about
yeah.
that.
Do you want to respond to that now, or should we just skip on?
I do have a thought about it.
Uh-huh.
My thought is that, well, generally, I think you know from my posts and from talking to me that I often feel that the discussion of this subject is not as clear-cut or as rational as it might be really on all sides.
Yes, yes.
And so when you talk about people who are doubters, what I think first about are the knee-jerk skeptics who, the minute they hear a report, they have to find all the reasons why it's probably wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't do anything else in quite a number of circumstances, I've seen them simply say, well, the witness didn't actually see what he or she said
mm-hmm.
they saw,
mm-hmm.
which is really very convenient. Of course, we know that people aren't always accurate in their reporting of anything, but on the other hand, they often are accurate, and to simply assume that they didn't see X, they saw Y instead, because if they saw Y, we can explain it. That strikes me as cavalier.
Yeah.
So I had said in my post, in response to the word skeptic, that I think we were stuck with that use of the word because they're institutionalized. They're like a political party.
Mm-hmm.
They have their publications, they have their organizations, and so skeptic appears to mean in practice now somebody who just says there can't be anything to it. But as Dignit pointed out, there's a very venerable philosophical meaning to it, which means that somebody who just is skeptical of everything, somebody who says, in effect, show me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had said that I really longed for that use of the word and that I would love to see a skeptic who, I don't know if I put it this way, but it's what I'm thinking now, among believers says, well, wait a minute, maybe there's a mundane explanation. And among skeptics says, now, wait a minute, you're explaining this too quickly. Maybe there is something mysterious going on.
Mm.
And doubter, I guess that would be the same thing, somebody who just doubts, except that it sounds so negative to me.
The expression skeptic has become a pejorative, too.
Terribly pejorative, yeah.
Yeah. As I recognize that cough, I hear that cough every 2 weeks on this program. Yeah, and the giggle, too. That's the giggle and cough of John Velez.
On a hot mic and didn't know it.
John and Greg are fairly well acquainted. They live in the same city. Have both worked with Bud Hopkins.
And I apologize for clearing my throat on air. I didn't think I was on.
I was chewing.
You'll get the hang of it. Listen, it's okay. Greg was sleeping. He forgot we were calling.
No, I was awake. I was reading the score of the Mahler 7th Symphony.
I need to sort of bring you guys together because I know that Greg has to go to bed very soon, and John and I have a couple of things that we need to go on and talk about. Because I know you guys don't, despite living in the same city, don't talk all the time, so it would be nice to just sort of meet through Toronto here with the meeting place. We had got to, I guess, the doubter, yeah.
I'd like to suggest a whole new category just for me. How about a skeptical believer?
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah.
Can I join?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My hand is waving in the air, too.
Yeah. It's tough to evaluate yourself when it comes to stuff like that. But I like to think of myself, as, because of the experiences that I've had in my life, I am a believer
mm-hmm.
that there is something very real going on. But I like to think that I've remained critical in my thinking and in what I'm willing to take on board.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I think most of us are inclined.
For me, another thing I put in that post we were talking about
mm-hmm.
is that there ought to be a word for somebody, and John, I think you suggested a really good one, for people who can tell the difference between what they believe and what they can prove.
Right.
Mm.
And I think John and I would probably agree on this. We believe that something is going on. John has much better reasons maybe than I do, but we know that there isn't scientific proof of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Or any really solid, reliable answers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Jan Aldrich is, as you said in your post to UFO Updates, Greg Sandow said, critical thinker.
Oh, he's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, yeah, a critical thinker. But the same time, you know, with... Oh, and Dick Hall said nice things about you too, John Velez. I want you to know.
Oh, I'm so sorry I missed this segment.
Yeah, well, you know, just
me and my computer.
Just get yourself a cheap PC and put real player in it,
just
and away you go.
To the show.
You know,
I'm gonna have to.
Yeah, and you take some of the huge amounts of money that we pay you every 2 weeks and spend it.
Yeah, and get yourself a broadband connection too. Don't have it.
High speed.
Use some of that Errol money for that.
I've completely forgotten where I was going now. So I'm just going to leave you guys talk.
Ah.
Hi, John. What have you proved lately?
10 minutes of dead air.
Yeah. Yeah, we had said critical thinking. Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a tough call for people that have had sightings and have had firsthand experiences, because that kind of shatters your worldview right then and there.
Yes.
And actually calls everything into question, everything you thought you believed, everything you thought you knew. I mean, I know I can only speak for myself, but I know I wasn't raised to believe that these things were real or even possible.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found myself confronted with a real-life situation where I had no choice but to accept what was in front of me and what my eyes and all my other senses were showing me, it really has a way of breaking you up into like 10,000 different pieces and making you doubt everything.
Mm.
And it's tough to maintain any kind of critical or clear thinking about it after having an experience like that.
Yeah, you know, John, I think that a lot of people... When they have an experience, they rush to embrace it totally uncritically. And
yeah, I have a serious problem around that, and
yeah,
I find that the majority of folks are like that, Greg. That's more the rule than the exception.
It's really sad because obviously, you know, since something has happened to them, they have a right to say yes, it's real. But to then to start jumping to conclusions like, oh, they're here for our betterment, they're really good, I know their names. When you get to that, it gets a little bit loopy.
Yeah.
You know, I think at the bottom of it all, for a lot of skeptics too, but especially in the case that we're discussing right now, somebody who's had an actual experience in their lives, that underneath it all, at the bottom layer, is fear and dealing with your own fear. And I think that there's some relief in the thought that, gee, maybe this is all for the greater good, or, you know, these are good things that are happening, or, you know, putting that kind of a spin on it kind of diffuses that fear.
And you know what it reminds me of? You remember Independence Day, the movie?
Mm.
Remember the character Tiffany who goes up to the top of the roof of the building in L.A. to welcome the alien?
With the sign,
That's right. It's one of the first to get blasted. Not to say that we think they're here, we know they're here to be hostile, but she just decided, oh my God, they're here, they love us, they must be good.
This is great,
And, you know, I think you're
point
right
well
about
made.
Fear in the case of skeptics. Sometimes their arguments are so irrational, and the skeptic in question, basically such a smart person, that I think, okay, they need to deny this. It's too much of a threat.
That was Greg, if I can cut in just for 1 second, you made a very interesting comment there. I have met and spoken with a couple of people that are really hardcore skeptics, and after several hours of being together and relaxing and talking and all of that, both of them admitted to me that they had UFO sightings in their life.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. And you know what?
I found that interesting.
It happened... Something like that happened to me once, and it was really dramatic. Let me take a moment to tell this story.
Can we hold can we hold the moment? Remember to tell us the story. But
when we come back.
Yes, because we need to go take a break for the news, and I didn't want you to get into the story and then cut you off, although, you know, we're about 30-40 seconds away. Talking of the skeptics who've had UFO experiences, Phil Klass is one of those people.
Hmm.
Phil Klass is probably the archest skeptic from PsyCop that there is. And just a lot of insensible silliness on a lot of his commentary. But a lovely man who has had a UFO experience was overheard at the PsyCop conference a couple of years ago when we were down there. Sue had happened to walk past him and heard him relating this story. And this is a man who's out there debunking all of this
stuff.
Been
running away from it ever since.
Yeah. Okay. we'll come back and hear Greg's interesting story. Greg Sando, John Velez down there in New York City. Strange days indeed. Off to the CFRB newsroom for the latest with John Elston on News Talk Radio CFRB 1010.
News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010. From Toronto, CFRB News starts now.
Good morning, it's 12:30. I'm John Elston. Traffic and weather together. First from the CFRB All-Day Traffic Center. May still find it slow going 401 East from Cambridge into Milton, where we have lane restrictions. CFRB Toronto weather from the Weather Network. Snow and breezy overnight down to -3. Snow tapering off, then partly sunny, windy, and 1 today. It's 0 degrees. In the news, a published report says one of the visiting IOC inspectors claims Beijing, China is not the odds-on favorite for the 2008 games that many people believe it is. The visiting delegation toured facilities such as York University and Cops Coliseum yesterday and will hold a briefing today before dining with the Prime Minister. It has been revealed there will be no public parking for ticket holders. In the waterfront area, spaces will be reserved for athletes and officials. The sister of a man who died along with his three children in a house fire in King Township a week ago spoke to some 800 people at their funeral in Aurora Saturday. Teresa Davis says her brother Keith and his children will live on through us. Meanwhile, hundreds paid respects to the late Cabinet Minister Al Palladini in Woodbridge. His funeral will be Monday morning. In a five-hour battle of computer programming skills and mental endurance, a team from the University of Toronto has won a bronze medal, and the University of Waterloo team captured gold. The International Computer Programming Competition was sponsored by IBM. In sports, the Leafs trail the Canucks 3-1 after two periods, or they're in the third now, and The Rock moved into first with an 11-7 win at Philadelphia. And now CFRB traffic and weather together. First to the CFRB All-Day Traffic Center. We have on the highways around town no word of any collisions now. Good driving conditions. The snow has not yet arrived in the Toronto area. Just looking through the MTO Compass System cameras at the 401 between Yonge and the 400. Everything appears to be running smoothly. On the eastbound side, approaching Highway 25 in Milton, it is down to one lane until noon today, and we had word that it was slow going approaching that area. CFRB Toronto weather from the Weather Network. Snow overnight, a southwest wind to 25 kilometers per hour, the low -3. Today, snow tapering off, 2 to 5 centimeters accumulation, a northwest wind to 35, the high 1. For Monday, rain or snow, breezy and up to 3. Right now it's 0 Celsius, that's 32 Fahrenheit. I'm John Elston. CFRB News next at 1 on the station with more than just headlines. CFRB 1010.
It's a digital rewind winner.
It's a great prize, don't you think so, Sandy Hymans?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, I won.
Tell us what we talked about and win a state-of-the-art JVC DVD player or a JVC high-band digital camcorder.
Oh, my kids are going to go crazy. Oh, they're going to go crazy.
Every week, someone wins a family trip for four to Orlando.
Pack your bag.
You could be next.
This will be such a nice family vacation.
Digital Rewind winner. Tell us what we talked about and win.
Rewind. Digital Rewind.
Strange days indeed is the program. My name is Errol Bruce Knapp. On the line with us from New York City, music critic, composer, and UFO scene observer Greg Sando. Also with us is, well, he's the webmaster of the Abduction Information Center, moderator of the Abduction Information Center's email list. He's a web designer, a commercial artist, a graphic artist, sorry, John. And he's been working with Bud Hopkins for
for many's, well, probably for 6 or 7 years now. John Velez is with us. And John mentioned skeptics having UFO experiences, which triggered a memory in Greg, and Greg was going to come back and regale us with a story. We're sort of slipping past the half hour, Greg. I hope it's okay.
Oh, that's no problem.
Okay, good.
So here's the story. A couple of years ago, I was asked to do an online chat for the Microsoft Network. Actually, they wanted me to do a chat simultaneously about classical music and UFOs. Oh. I thought it was one of the odder ideas I'd ever heard. So I suggested that they separate them. So I did. I did one on music. I did one on UFOs. And my subject with UFOs, my particular subject, is abductions. And there was one guy participating who was a pretty extreme skeptic about abductions. And in fact, he started sending me private messages in which he said really kind of silly things like, if Bud Hopkins was serious about researching this subject, Bud would go back to college in his late 60s, I might add, and get a degree in physics. Then we'd know Bud was serious. So this guy, obviously, he had a chip on his shoulder, shall we say, about the subject. And, you know, it didn't bother me. I've run into this before.
Mm.
So sometime later, I joined a UFO email list other than updates.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine that there is another one.
Well, yeah, there's Project 1947, which I know both you and I are on, and I am reading Andy Roberts' posts, by the way.
Good for you, Errol. Tolerant of you. But anyway, in fact, it was on that list. Somebody who posted there, I recognized the email address as being this person who had come after me on this online chat.
Oh, really?
And I realized that on this list, he was really quite reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I thought nothing of it. I just thought abductions are a subject that makes him crazy. So at one point, he emailed me privately and asked if he could discuss something. And what he wanted to discuss, and I think you can see this coming,
mm-hmm.
is that he had every sign of being an abductee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that he is one. Only he can decide that. Certainly not for me to say.
Yep.
But all the things that make people think they might be had been going on all of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was quick to apologize for how he behaved during the online chat and to say that what must have occurred to everybody right now, that he was in denial about it, that he wanted to push it away, and that's why he'd been so hostile.
Yes.
So here was a case of somebody coming right out and saying it.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's someone here in Toronto like that, too. That I worked with for a while, who, you know, is very adamant about, you know, that this field should not include abductions.
But I think that may be a lot more prevalent among the hardcore skeptics than we imagine.
Hmm. But this man, you know, I obviously the guy that Greg is talking about and the guy that I'm talking about are involved in this field, you know? I mean, they're not hardcore skeptics.
Yeah, this man was not skeptical about other UFO things.
Exactly.
But I must say I've run into that before, and one great example is Kevin Randall, who's one of the principal investigators of the Roswell crash, and
yes.
somebody who to this day, even after the skeptics have more or less taken the initiative and the lead in that debate, Kevin still maintains that it was alien. But Kevin has actually written a book which is very hostile to the whole idea of abduction,
mm-hmm.
Hostile to abductees and to abduction investigators.
Yeah, I remember John Velez and Kevin Randall hashing it out on the list, in fact.
I just wrote to Bruce McAbee about the very same thing. There are some people out there who were willing to acknowledge that they believe in UFOs, that UFOs are real, but won't go the extra step and give any kind of credence or credibility to the fact that they may be in contact with human beings.
See, it's one thing if they're flying around, and it's something else if they're in your bedroom.
Yeah.
That's a lot worse.
Well, yeah. Whew.
Again, the fear factor.
It is the fear factor, and, you know, I felt that myself. When I was first getting into this, it was because I had a magazine assignment to write about UFOs, and I called up everybody whose books I'd read. I went and interviewed them. So I went and I talked to David Jacobs, who, of course, is, along with Bud, maybe one of the two top leading abduction people.
Mm-hmm.
And David, I asked him, is there physical evidence? And he says, you want to see? He goes out of the room and he comes back, and he has these garments. He had a T-shirt and he had a bed sheet, and they both had these pink stains.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains to me, and it's really quite a story, how these stains were left simultaneously on the clothes of four different people in one family who were sleeping in four different locations on the same night. And so my reaction, having read David's book, he had only one at that time, and read Bud's books and believed every word of them, was to say, oh, give me a break, this can't be real. Because once it's under my nose, I think, uh-oh, this is dangerous.
Mm. Were those the yellowish stains, sulfur?
These were pink.
Oh, pink.
He said that they'd faded a great deal, and in fact, he hadn't looked at them for a while, and he was surprised by how much they faded. But they were pink. They were almost shocking pink.
Mm.
I've heard of yellow ones. I've heard of brown stains.
Well, the yellow stains are, and a sulfuric.
Let's not go there.
A sulfuric.
Thank you, John.
The yellow stains. The yellow stains and the smell of sulfur off people's bodies when they've been taken and brought back. Very interesting.
I think the fear factor plays a huge role. Any thoughtful person, and I mean that, it has to be a thoughtful person who looks into the subject has got to find it terrifying. And I think that a lot of folks, their response to that primal reaction to the subject is to run in the entirely opposite direction. And I think that accounts for the vehemence in some of the attacks that come from some of the skeptics.
And you know, John, I think it accounts for something else we see too, which is the way a lot of ufologists who do believe in alien visits get caught up in the minutiae of the field. That is, they'd rather analyze whether photographs are true or not than deal with the implications. And by the way, I'm not saying that they should not be analyzing the photographs or that they're bad people.
Right.
But I'll give you two quick stories. One is that when I first met Kevin Randall, I said, so Kevin, you feel that you've proved that aliens are here. How does that make you feel? Does that surprise or bother you at all? He says, no. He says, I've been used to that ever since I was a kid reading science fiction. And so I thought in the privacy of my mind, but I did not say to him, oh, sure. And then Dick Hole, when I first met him, I asked him a similar question, and he said that he hadn't faced up to the implications until he went to a 1992 abduction conference.
Mm-hmm.
First started confronting abductions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then that the impact of it really hit.
Which also, Greg, that brings us back to what you said initially, that there's a large number of people that have a reaction to the phenomena where they embrace it and sublimate it and turn it into something. You know, they're here to save the Earth, or it's going to be this big, wonderful thing where the human race is going to be enlightened by these beings. And I think that a lot of it comes from that reaction to the primal fear,
mm-hmm.
that any kind of a more than superficial investigation into the subject is going to produce in people. I think it's a normal response to be scared of the unknown, you know, to feel a fear of the unknown.
You know, now I'm thinking of somebody, a very sweet woman I know, who is an abductee. And she started believing that maybe some of the stuff in abduction books was true. That is, that they weren't really benign beings and that they may have some agenda which, at the very least, is not our agenda. And it bothered her, and she said to me, but I always believed, you know, that the universe was a good place and that any spirits that came to us would be good. Now, how can I believe that if these beings aren't good? And I remember saying to her, I said, you know, you can still, for example, be a religious person and still understand that Hitler did everything that he did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it just split her mind open.
Or that in nature, big fish eat little fish. You know?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I want to go to the long distance line here and bring in Michel Deschamps, who's up there in Sudbury and always manages to get at least one call into the program. Michel Deschamps, MUFON Ontario, section director for Sudbury.
Hey guys.
Hey Michel.
Hey.
How are you?
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something like, for myself, I think in a way, even being an eyewitness to 18-odd sightings, I'm kind of, I don't know if I'd call it skeptical or whatever, but like even years after the fact, you even sort of go back to the sighting and say, did I really see that? Because it's so much out of the ordinary. I think a lot of times I get a lot of flack because people are saying, well, it could be this and it couldn't be that. I always have my list and I only go so far, but I won't be one of those people who say, well, okay, yeah, they come from the Orion Belt, and this is what the civilization is like, this is what they eat, and this is what they're here for.
Right.
Those are the questions that where the speculation comes in, because we don't know those answers. We don't know why they're here, what their true intentions are, what do their races are called, what do they go by. You know, we call them Nordics and all that stuff, the orange, the blues, the reds, but we don't really know what they are. Other than the descriptions and the several sketches that have been made. And I've never seen beings, but I have a late uncle who had seen beings, and obviously what he saw was not at all, did not conform to some of the numerous sketches that I've seen even. And my 18 sightings, although they're all, you know, different from one for the other, I still sometimes just go back and I shake in my boots, because one particular sighting, I kind of speculated that they were checking out the radar base, because the radar base had been abandoned by then, and that this thing was hovering right next to it, although I didn't see a ladder fold out and things come out. I just saw this big, bright, oval, pinkish-white light hover next to the radar base, and I sort of assumed that they were checking it out, obviously knowing, they must have known that this thing was no longer operating, and they hadn't been tracked by that same radar base way back in 75, so...
Michelle said something that really struck me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said that there are times when, in spite of having had 18 sightings, he goes over it in his mind and thinks, well, have I really had these sightings? Are they really what I thought they were?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what I meant earlier. This is the true meaning of skepticism, where you just want to say, show me. Let me not believe something until I've really proven that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you believe something as really striking as the belief that aliens are here and you yourself have seen them or have some contact with them, that is really a good idea to go over that very, very carefully in your mind and say, well, am I really sure? It's not that you should doubt yourself, but that you should just straighten out your thoughts, lest you go riding off, you know, into the sunrise in some, you know, in some height of absurdity. And I must say that John, of the many people I've known in this field, does just about the best job of keeping his feet on the ground while understanding that he has had these experiences. It's really impressive, John.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just think it's a sign of a healthy, normal psychology if you question your own experiences. I don't see anything wrong in that.
I mean, we do that in everyday life.
Yeah,
you don't
with
have
everything
to be
else.
To do that.
Exactly.
All you have to do is be married.
Yeah.
Any happily married person knows exactly.
Hey, Greg,
what
it was great spending a little time with you. We have to physically get together. We're not that far.
That's
apart.
The next step.
Mm.
And Errol, I want to thank you for inviting me to come on. It really was a pleasure.
And I love having you on. You just there's this air of sanity about you. You know. In among all of the apparent people, crazed people that a lot of people maintain we have on this program. So
well,
thank you for that aura.
Glad I can help. Thanks, and Michelle, nice to meet you.
Same here.
Yeah.
Good night, Greg Sando.
Good night.
Good night, Greg. Best
thank
to
you.
Ann.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Well, an email here that I want to touch on, if I can just get back to it again. Where is it? Oh, yes. From Linda. She says, I can't find any of those Mars photos at www.enterprisemission.com. What am I doing wrong? Well, Linda, if you're still out there, because you sent this about an hour ago, and I just got to it now. If you're still out there and you go to enterprisemission.com, and what you will see there, and let me just go back, because it's changed slightly since
if she scrolls down the page, Errol,
yeah,
to the Arthur C. Clarke.
Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah, but I'm very aware of that, but things have changed at that website. Sir Arthur gets his explanation is good,
And Linda, if you can look at that one, but the earlier one is better to start with. Arthur C. Clarke discovers the glass worms of Mars, and that's dated the 26th of February. So there to answer that question. And the discussion continues, John Velez. Dave Ferlot and I talked about this situation, the glass worms, the tubes, whatever it is, the hell they are, on Mars. And we had a long discussion with Steve Bassett about it down there in Washington.
And Stephen's take?
Yeah, he's as puzzled as the rest of us are by it. You know, he talked about the 80,000-odd pictures that have been taken of Mars, and this dumping that's been going on, putting everything out on the web and letting us pick our way through them. And he was saying that from the people that he's been talking with, there's only about 4,000 of those tens of thousands of images that have been looked at. So we don't know.
What's being held in abeyance? Right?
Well, it's not so much holding it in abeyance, John. I mean, we wouldn't have known about these unless there were several people out there who passed
taking
their
the
information
time to look
on.
At them, yeah.
And you know how long it takes to scroll down and carefully look at every one of those images because they're long.
Which historically used to be the job of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I thought that was part of the reason we were funding those people with taxpayer money.
Yeah.
Now the public is handling the work.
But they have to handle the criticism that they weren't releasing images. So right. The way you do it is you just dump it all out,
yeah.
You know, and say, here, kids, go play.
Yeah.
You know, and we spend 40 years looking at these things.
Yeah.
But eventually somebody will have looked at them all and will have noted all the anomalies. And then at that point, probably NASA is going to have to say, well, yes, we've been looking at them too, and we're damned if we know what they are. Let's go look, man, you know, mission.
I have to get out to the Enterprise website and check this out, because according to what you just read on the air, Arthur C. Clarke got a response, and I'm curious if the response was from NASA.
Yeah, well, I didn't get a chance to read it because
right.
I'm working on the radio, but it is there.
Yeah.
Actually, it's Opening a Martian Can of Worms by Ron Nix, geologist, TerraCon, a geotechnical engineering company, Enterprise Mission Consulting Geologist. So that doesn't sound like NASA responding.
No, not at all. Actually, what I'd like to do, one of the posters, Josh Goldstein, mm-hmm. made a really terrific suggestion. I'm here in New York, and there are bulletin boards at NYU and at Columbia University where I can ask to see if there's any geology professors that are interested in looking at those pictures and,
yeah.
and offering an opinion.
I think that's a swell idea, John.
I would love to hear the response of a geologist or a planetary geologist. Maybe there's someone at one of these universities that specializes in planetary geology.
Mm.
I won't know until I inquire. But I'd really love to get some professional opinions.
Yeah. Well, Bruce Cornett's a geologist, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen any comment from him yet. He's one of the people that has worked with Stanley McDaniel at SPSR. And Dick Hall and I were talking about that a little earlier on in this program. Wow, what a tightly interwoven program tonight. It's
just... Where's NASA's focus then going to end up if the... the X-33 program has been canceled.
Well, I think it's full steam ahead to Mars by the sound of it. You know, they've cut down X-33. They've cut down certain additions
yeah.
to the space
so,
station.
I don't believe it. Good luck. They talk about sending somebody to Mars just like they talk about putting people on the moon, and I don't see it happening.
Well, the thing is now, Michelle, that I don't know if you've been keeping up with the new propulsion systems that they have, but they figure they can send somebody, you know, there and back in 3 months, 90 days each way.
Wow. Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, if what the astronauts had said about what they had seen on the moon, and apparently they were told to stay away from the moon, and we've just been sending probes ever since, obviously probably the same thing is going to be said about Mars. I mean, the Mars Observer disappeared, the Phobos 2 probe,
mm-hmm.
like, who knows? What's
well,
happening?
It's going to be interesting to see, you know, which one of these theories comes to light. It comes
but
to bear.
At what price? Who's going to die?
You know, one of the more compelling stories connected with that is has to do with that Russian probe that disappeared, and the last photograph it took shows this huge cigar-shaped object.
Phobos 2. Phobos 15 and a half mile long.
Yeah. Did anything ever, have you heard anything, Michelle? Has there been any further?
The only person who would know would be Paul Stonehill.
Okay. Well, I'll have to ask him.
He's the one who broke the story, and George Knapp.
Anybody did any more analysis?
Not that I know.
Yeah, well, I think James Oberg had something to say about that. Yeah.
Well, he's the NASA spokesperson.
The NASA apologist.
The NASA apologist, yes.
Yeah.
I like yours better. Aaron.
No, that's Stan Friedman. You know, don't be a ufologist apologist. And it also, both Dick Hall and Greg Sandow in the discussion on UFO updates about terminology apologist came up. So, yeah.
Yeah, we've got to come up with something better than believer. I hate that term.
Gentlemen, our time together is done, unfortunately. John Velez, your website, www.spacelab.net/tilde-JVIF/default-HTM. If you didn't get that, don't worry about it. Give the station a call on Monday. Ask for Carlo, the information officer. He will have a copy of all of these email addresses and URLs that we've given out this evening. They will be there for your grabbing. John Velez, Michelle, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Knapp.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Velez. Monsieur Deschamps, merci.
Sorry about taking up your time, Don.
No, I love having you around.
He's worried about, how am I going to fill half an hour? Good night, guys.
Good night.
Oh, yes. I want to give you out the UFO reporting number for Mutual UFO Network of Ontario is 905-278-9596. 905-278-9596. Are you waving fingers at me to get out of here? Is that what you're doing, Graham? I've hit the post every time, so I can be a little later this time. Oh, he has a promo. Okay, have to get out of here. That's this week's look at Strange Days Indeed. You can email us, the address sdi@cfrb.com. Thanks to Graham Elliott out there, who has a promo waiting to go in the control room. Strange Days Indeed is copyright of and is co-produced by WT Fit and Random Records, and he ran the music out of me. The exec producer, started again, is Gene Mascardelli. The producer, well, that's me. Join us again next week. I'm Errol Bruce Knapp, and this is CFRB 1010. John Elston is next from the CFRB Newsroom. Good night.